The following program has language that might be offensive, depending on your definition of might and offensive and your understanding of the language. It's Tuesday, February 15th. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. My favorite Harry Potter spell is Judgment Non Abstanto Verdicto. Actually, that is not a Harry Potter spell. That is a legal spell, or Latin for a decision in a court of law, judgment notwithstanding the verdict. J-N-O-V, non abstanto verdicto. I love it when the Latin that you guess on happens to be the real Latin. It's so cool. And another cool guy is Judge Jed Rakoff, who issued that judgment non abstanto verdicto in the case he was overseeing, which dealt with charges brought by Sarah Palin against the New York Times. To recount, the New York Times had, in 2017, run an editorial about incendiary rhetoric among politicians leading to real-life violence. Palin was in that editorial because supposedly her PAC put out a graphic showing a target over Gabby Gifford's district, because that district was a seat that Sarah PAC was targeting. And then Giffords was shot. Only the connection had and has been debunked. Giffords would-be assassin had fixated on the congresswoman, planned to target her years before the graphic was ever in existence. Sarah Palin really had nothing to do with that horrible crime. So the New York Times, in including this claim in an editorial, was sloppy, rash, and wrong. But that doesn't mean they were malicious, as defined by the law. And that's a key component in a libel or defamation claim. So key that Judge Rakoff said, you know what? I don't care what the jury says. Team Palin just didn't get there. Case dismissed. But he said this as the jury had already begun deliberations. So the judge also said, I know this is going to be appealed. And don't you think it would be interesting to see what the jury is going to say? Okay. No one tell them. All right, guys, everyone agree. Come on now. Don't ruin the surprise. Oh, also, don't come walking in like 20 minutes after the time on the invite. So the jury clearly sees you and is like, wait, what are you guys doing here? And you're like, just happened to be in the area carrying these wrapped presents and balloons saying, sorry, Sarah, case dismissed. Don't do that, the judge said. You know, also seem miffed by the judge's decision? Former Alaska governor and woman not responsible for an attempted assassination just because she happened to draw crosshairs on a map where a shooting occurred, Sarah Palin. Outside the courthouse yesterday, she began with a no comment.
Okay, we're not going to make a statement yet because the jury still has it in front of them, which leads me to say...
Oh, it's starting to sound like it's going to be a statement. Go ahead.
This is a jury trial. And we always thank jurors. We always appreciate the system. So whatever happened in there kind of usurps the system that I believe we're used to and we respect and works.
Well, Governor Palin will be happy to know that the jury did come in. And as on that popular game show imported from Britain, we got to know what they would have said.
But before you go, I'd like to know what you would have said if you'd have had that much more sense in your gut.
Blaise Pascal.
And if you'd have done that, you'd have been in a world of pain, because that's the right answer.
And Sarah Palin also would have been in a world of pain, because the jury sided with the New York Times. No defamation. And Palin's wager, unlike Pascal's, cost her more than just a little time on Earth. On the show today, I shall talk you through a somewhat obscure sentence tucked inside a court filing that has set the world of Trump backers ablaze. Among their arguments, Trump is vindicated in every way. Hillary Clinton is the real puppet. That is, once again, among their arguments. But first, if you ever heard of the pharmaceutical maker Insys, it's probably for one of three reasons. One, you or a family member were experiencing breakthrough cancer pain and needed their powerful under-the-tongue opiate, or you were suffering routine pain and a doctor, through venality or carelessness, thought it would be okay to prescribe you this powerful opiate off-label. The third reason why you may know the name is that you followed the news about this opiate maker and their prosecution. You recall that Insys, the maker of Subsys, was the rare company where RICO charges were successfully brought, and drug makers went to jail. Journalist Evan Hughes has that story of how it all happened in his new book, The Hard Sell: Crime and Punishment at an Opioid Startup. He joins me next. About 10 years ago, Insys, a billion-dollar pharmaceutical company, was raking in money. Their star drug, Subsys, was an under-the-tongue spray that could quickly counter the fiercest pain, so-called breakthrough pain that a cancer patient might experience. But the thing is, even if all the cancer patients legitimately being treated for breakthrough pain took Subsys, it wouldn't account for all the record-breaking sales they were experiencing, because Subsys consisted of a killer ingredient. Literally, perhaps you've heard of it, fentanyl. Insys didn't invent fentanyl. They weren't the first to exploit fentanyl. What they did was essentially weaponize fentanyl. They exploited a system that was ripe for exploitation. The result was a 10-week trial, followed by 15 days of deliberation, where the company's founder and key executives were fined and jailed. It's all chronicled in The Hard Sell: Crime and Punishment at an Opioid Startup. Evan Hughes wrote the book. He's with me now. Thanks for coming on, Evan.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the outline of their operation, how it grew, and what their strategy is. And then I have a lot of questions about implications. So in the early days of Insys, who was John Kapoor, the CEO, and what was he trying to do with the drug market?
So John Kapoor comes up with this drug, Subsys, and he is trying to enter this market. It's a niche market for extremely potent opioids that are fast acting. They're supposed to be taken on top of other opioids to counter this breakthrough pain, as you said. And his late wife had died of cancer and had suffered terrible pain. So that was always the origin story that he told, that he wanted to develop a drug that would help people like her. And spends a great deal of money developing this drug, which is not unusual. It takes like a decade. And then when the drug launches to the market, as you say, about 10 years ago, initially, it's basically a flop.
Because when you look at it, like, what's the potential audience for it?
The potential audience is always small. The breakthrough cancer pain, it's going to be a niche drug. And it is an expensive drug, to be fair. So there's still some potential for revenue there. But what Kapoor and his allies kind of figure out is that even before they come along, the majority of the market isn't actually breakthrough cancer pain patients. The majority of the market is people experiencing all kinds of pain. So these drugs, that their little group of competitors, these rapid onset opioids, they've already been targeting so-called off-label prescribing, meaning prescribing that's not for the indication that it was initially conceived for. Mm-hmm. And so they start going after basically prolific prescribers of opioids more generally, who have some history with these drugs. And a lot of them have very few cancer patients to begin with.
Right. So let me pause you there and just go back a little bit about Kapoor. Who's he? Is he a chemist? Is he a businessman? Is he, a pharmaceutical genius? Is he a scoundrel? Who is he?
you really put a name to all of those things. I mean, he gets his PhD in biochemistry, but like before that, he is born in India. He comes to the US with the proverbial $5 in his pocket, gets his PhD, goes into pharma, makes some incredibly smart moves early on. And by the time he's founding Insys, he is mega wealthy already. You know, he's always constantly got his fingers in a number of different companies, startups. He's like seeding this company with money. He's running this other company. And a lot of them run into some regulatory trouble. And he's known as kind of like, he's always just kind of one step above, ahead of the law or the regulation.
Although sometimes not. I mean, he has been fined, right, in the past.
Absolutely. And, you know, he was hauled before a congressional committee and pled the fifth about problems at one company. He was sued and settled, you know, multiple lawsuits at prior companies. But again, like, not all of that is that unusual in pharma.
So these fast-acting fentanyl, extreme painkiller drugs or euphoria-inducing drugs, one was a pill, then there was a lollipop, and he invented the or developed this sublingual fast-acting right under the tongue application. But that wasn't, as we've documented, that wasn't necessarily the killer app because there weren't enough prescribers of it for its on label use. Give me a sense of the off-label world. Is it inherently nefarious? Any doctor who goes off-label is doing something wrong? Is it a kind of everyone knows that, you know, off-label uses are sometimes totally legitimate. It's just that the FDA is they're kind of slow to approve these things. Give me a sense of the ethics in general of off-label prescriptions.
So that's a good question, because off-label prescribing, you know, even just the terminology makes it sound kind of sinister. And
it does,
and it's right. Really not inherently sinister. You know, probably, you know, your listeners, we may all have been prescribed something off-label, like people who are trying to quit smoking. Sometimes they'll prescribe Wellbutrin, which is an antidepressant. You might have like seizure medication is used for bipolar disorder or depression. But what you have here in this case is an extremely potent painkiller. And so the reason it's approved is, you know, the FDA studies it for a particular use. In this case, the use of like breakthrough cancer pain. And so you've got patients who are really in dire straits, and that the FDA is deciding not that it's safe, period, but that the drug is safe enough relative to the benefits for that particular patient. So, but it's just a very different case, right? If you're an end-stage cancer patient, you want the most powerful thing out there. And it's legitimate for society to want a powerful medication for that person. Totally different story if you have a patient who has moderate chronic back pain. And you're giving them this medication that, you know, used to be only available in a hospital setting, and you know, saying here's a box of this medication, and it's so liable to misuse, abuse, dependency. So a lot of these doctors who are the top prescribers were essentially reckless prescribers, and Insys went right after them with their marketing efforts.
Was this a unique insight to them? Oh my God, we have this list. Or was this well known in the pharmaceutical industry that anyone can access a list of the people who are the top opioid prescribers in America?
Yeah, well known in the industry that, you know, you can purchase data from third-party companies that collect it from pharmacies that tell you like who are the top prescribers of a particular class of drug or what have you. And the detail, you know, it's pretty granular. Every pharmacy transaction. So, you know, when you and I fill a script, the pharma industry knows about it.
Yeah.
And they know what doctor gave it to you. And then they go visit those doctors and literally knock on their door. Not everybody knows this, that, you know, drug companies, they blanket the country with sales reps who have given territory. And then they go knocking on doors face to face and try to build relationships with those doctors and persuade them.
So once they had the list, that wasn't it. That didn't solve all their problems. They still had to use techniques to get in there and to get the doctors to prescribe it. Tell me about some of those techniques that you chronicle.
You're right. They needed something to differentiate themselves from the competitors who were also all going after these top doctors. Insys's technique was to use a so-called speaker program, which is not an uncommon thing in the pharma industry, but to use it as essentially a bribery vehicle. You go to these top doctors, you say, we're going to hire you to give little talks to other potential prescribers of the drug, and you're going to tout the benefits of the drug. And, you know, that's a perfectly legitimate sort of peer-to-peer marketing idea that is used widely in pharma. But the head of sales that they hired, who's kind of this crazy character in the book, Alec Berlikoff, he says, look, the programs, they really don't matter. It's not about the presentations. It's not about what this doctor teaches other doctors. The point is, we keep feeding money to the speaker. Every time he gives the little talk, he gets his like $2,000 or $3,000 just to have dinner. We'll do it like once a week and get these guys on the payroll. And in return, they're gonna prescribe the product.
Yeah. And with some of the audiences, they were audiences of zero. They literally were speaking to no one.
Exactly. It would be the doctor going out to dinner with the sales rep and getting paid. And, you know, the deal was you keep prescribing a lot of substances. And if you don't, we're going to take you off the speaker program. Does the patient enter into this calculation at all? No. You've got to keep writing it no matter what patients are turning up at the office this week.
As I read the narrative, the forward propulsive narrative, you do take some time to point out the effect on real people. And I wanted to do that in this interview as well. So could you just take a moment and talk about someone? They take this, their doctor gives it to them. I would imagine, at least in most cases that you talk about, it's not with a wink and a nudge. It's the doctor is prescribed. They are asking for pain medicine and they're getting it from their doctor. Perhaps they don't know how potent it is or aren't worried about the addictive qualities. What happens to them?
One patient I talked to was a patient of this clinic in Mobile, Alabama, that was a real target of INSYS, a marketing target. And in fact, so much so that CEO and founder of the company both go there to try and strike a sort of shady deal with these doctors. And at the other end of that is a patient, of course, but many patients. One of them was this woman, Tamison, and she went in and she really had no sense of, she was not someone who really followed the news. She wouldn't have recognized the term pill mill. Mm-hmm. She had no sense of like, you should be maybe a little wary about opioids and about a pain clinic. So this is not someone who's coming in as a so-called drug seeker. You know, there's a lot of demonization of pain patients. That's not what this was. This was someone who did not know what she was getting into. She's suffering from pain after a surgery, kind of a botched hernia surgery. And she's prescribed substance right off the bat at 600 micrograms, which is six times the recommended starting dose, and she becomes addicted. She told me right from the beginning, she knew she was in trouble. She kept taking more and more. She would run out of it early. And normally, like a pain doctor would cut someone off in this circumstance, would try and refer them to treatment, but she stayed. And, you know, this clinic was such a mess that eventually, like a nurse practitioner who was seeing her in her office literally passed out because she herself was addicted to and misusing opioids. And that was the wake-up call that, you know, this patient sought treatment herself. But her life really had fallen apart by that point.
Seems like INSYS was doing a whole lot that was so apparently wrong. It wasn't necessarily a slam dunk that they'd get a conviction on RICO charges, because it was, at least as I read about it and you describe it, somewhat of a unique or novel prosecution. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, it was groundbreaking. Normally, the way these things proceed is that eventually the company settles. And that's the end of that. Well, in this case, they pressed criminal charges against the individuals who actually made these decisions at the top of the company. What that meant is the company couldn't settle it. The company wasn't even the defendant here. The people were. So they were going to have to either plead guilty or fight in court. They did. They chose to fight. And that was typical of John Kapoor, the top guy. And what that meant was we had a trial, and the mere existence of the trial was itself groundbreaking. You know, that's not what happens. Purdue Pharma, they settle. Cephalon, another opioid company, they settle. And not to mention all the pharma companies outside of opioids. So the trial, I mean, there's nothing like the public reckoning of a trial. And it was a really fascinating experience to watch, because it's like you get the window into everything that happened inside the halls of this company. And you're right, it wasn't a slam dunk, despite all this evidence that they left. because they were prosecuting them for racketeering conspiracy. They were kind of going for gold.
So here are my questions about the implications of what you reported. One is, I got the sense that some of the stuff they were doing was so over the top. I wonder if it was unrepresentative of the real problem. I mean, I'm glad you put it in the book. It was compelling to read. But if people want to know, you know, what is the story of the opioid problem in America, it's actually not, you know, one malefactor who doesn't care about the rules and an exotic dancer and rap videos. That really doesn't actually describe the bulk of the problem.
You're right. These guys were an outlier. They went way beyond the law and they were uniquely reckless in leaving evidence of it. But these weren't new techniques. It isn't new to use a speaker program as a kind of indirect bribe. Like, you're paying that doctor. Why are you paying him? To get some FaceTime with him? Because you hope he prescribes. You know, it's not new to kind of massage the facts to get things through insurance. And nothing they did was truly new. And what I think you see in the book is that it's kind of like if you have I draw an analogy that if you've got a 55 mile an hour speed limit in the business that's meant to protect the patients, INSYS was like, as you say, they're the outlier. They're the guys like going 85 and weaving in and out of traffic. But what everybody else is doing is still going 75 and still like, getting a better and better radar detector and figuring out where they can get away with going 85 and gaming the system. And like, I don't think that ends just because INSYS got ticketed.
As you point out, these speaker series, that has been something that prosecutors, but also the industry itself, has looked to reform. It seems like there are other established ways of doing business that INSYS took advantage of. I'd like your thought on a couple of them. One is it possible, is it advisable for the government to say when there are drugs that are too dangerous to be prescribed in off-use cases, they simply cannot be prescribed in off-use cases?
That's interesting. It would be a pretty radical change from the way these things are regulated, because what the FDA says is, well, we just make judgments about medications and about what pharma companies can do in terms of marketing, but we don't regulate what doctors do. And in a way, the doctor is the source of the problem. They're the ones who have the power to go off label. And, you know, state medical boards are the ones that police doctors, but not all that well, in my opinion. So if you could have a system like that, where the doctor has to sign something that says this is the diagnosis, I still think it would be gamed a little bit. But that's not a bad idea. With a drug this powerful, I'm not sure it should be prescribed ever off-label. You know, has it helped any off-label patients? Probably. There's probably some. But I'm not sure it's worth it.
What about the existence of these lists where you could find the number 1 through 10 prescribing doctors? I mean, I look at it like the drug itself is the missile, but that's the missile guidance system.
Yeah. So that is kind of amazing to me that drug companies have access to all this data. You know, Vermont tried to make a law to outlaw that, and it was defeated in court on First Amendment grounds. In INSYS's case, there was something even more perverse that went on, which is like the FDA said, well, these drugs are so serious and so potent that you need to have this like special closed system of distribution. Every prescription is a matter of record, is tracked almost in real time. And the purpose is to protect patient safety and maybe weed out bad doctors. But INSYS ends up using it as like a marketing tool. They've got even better data now that they can exploit to target the top doctors.
Do you think our society can prosecute itself out of the opioid epidemic?
No, I don't think so. One good question you could raise about the INSYS case is like, why did it get to the law, which is kind of like the backstop at the end of everything, right? That means like the regulations have failed all along the way that might have stopped INSYS at an earlier point. I think you need better systems in place all the way from day one.
The name of the book is The Hard Sell, Crime and Punishment at an Opioid Startup. Evan Hughes is the author. It's simultaneously a rollicking read and a really disturbing statement about the state of things in the United States and the pharmaceutical industry. Great talking to you, Evan.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
And now the spiel. John Durham, the federal prosecutor appointed by Bill Barr, who is winding up cases around the Steele dossier and Trump's alleged ties to Russian election interference, issued a court filing at the end of last week. It seemed fairly routine. It was about a defendant named Michael Sussman, who faces the charge that he lied to the FBI. Sussman had worked for the Clinton campaign. That's why he was charged with lying. He didn't disclose that. And legal experts do consider this to be a fairly weak case to show my cards. I could find a legal expert to call it a strong case, but what I've done is rely on the folks at Lawfare who describe the charges against Sussman as rather curious, but on the other hand, describe the charges that Durham filed against a different defendant, Igor Danchenko, as pretty serious and damning if proved. But these new filings in the Sussman case, they were made for pretty boring reasons to discuss possible conflicts of interest that Sussman's lawyers might have. But within those filings, there was a paragraph and a phrase or two that pretty much blew this whole operation sky high. And I want to prejudice you with my read of it. Here is how Fox News described the explosive paragraph.
Durham also writes that during Sussman's trial, the government will establish that among the internet data tech executive one and his associates exploited was domain name system DNS internet traffic pertaining to a particular healthcare provider, a Trump Tower, a Donald Trump Central Park West apartment building, and the executive office of the President of the United States, EOP.
Yeah, I know. Let it sink in. This might be one of those moments where you'll always remember where you were before and where you were after hearing this reality redefining news. Wait, you're not getting it? Well, let me help you along. This is how the conservative website The Federalist interpreted what you just heard. The headline of their article was, Special Counsel, Democrats framed and spied on Trump while he was president. Let me explain what the author, Margaret Cleveland, is alleging. One of Sussman's clients, a guy named Ronald Jaffe, is a technology expert. And according to Cleveland's reading of the case, Jaffe had a way of seeing some websites that Donald Trump's organization and administration were accessing. And Sussman dangled this fact in front of the FBI and maybe the CIA as if to say, see, Trump's using Russian websites. He's using Russian technologies. You might want to investigate Trump. That's at least what Cleveland decided that those sentences meant in the Durham filing. I do have to say that interpretation requires quite a few leaps and assumptions of facts not in evidence, possibly not even facts at all. First of all, the document was just a few pages. It was pretty terse. It in no way implicated Hillary Clinton. It didn't talk about infiltration. There was no allegation that Hillary Clinton attempted to monitor Trump after Trump became president. That is part of the allegation. These are all alleged to have occurred in 2017. And you heard the headline, spied on Trump while he was president. I don't even know if Trump was alleging that this happened. But there is an alternative explanation, and it is one that has been reported on widely. It's been out there for months, that the spying wasn't spying. It was monitoring of security breaches. And it didn't even take place during the Trump administration. Jaffe had a contract with the Obama administration. He was looking at Obama administration websites and cell phone activity, trying to guard against breaches. He once got an award from the FBI for doing a good job with that. And remember, Russia had hacked the DNC server. Might the Russians be going after the Democrat then in the White House? Barack Obama seems at least a reasonable thing to worry about. Investigators indeed picked up on an oddity. There was activity on Russian-made cell phones called the Yota phone. They feared this could be a security risk. And as we know with Yota, fear leads to hate.
Hate leads to suffering.
Oh, different Yota. This Yota phone is a little known and even less loved model in the West. One online reviewer, a British limo driver who also reviews tech named Tony Volokin, had this recommendation as regards the Yota phone.
Do not buy this phone.
Unambiguous. Another tech site featured an interview with Yota Phone CEO Vlad, who displayed the phone's main selling point. It has displays on two different sides.
So this is the Yota Phone 2. It has the regular display on the front and the electronic paper display on the back.
So like the other Yota, information somewhat backwards it conveys. But the Trump defending right, they weren't buying that this was all about some Yota phones. No, it went deeper, they thought, and it seems to have no outward boundaries. Dan Bongino has spent both days this week mostly talking about the Durham revelations to his 8.5 million listeners. He wants everyone to know that the revelations aren't just that Trump's been exonerated. He helps the audience parse the evidence.
Durham's filing clearly says that the DNS data is among the internet data exploited, among it.
Bongino really needs to emphasize this point, among.
But notice very clearly, he says that it is among the internet data they exploited, among.
Wait, I wasn't listening. What was the key word?
Listen to this. Among the internet data that this tech executive and his associates exploited.
What did they say?
They say among the internet data they have.
I listened to 2 hours of Monday and Tuesday's Dan Bongino shows. He struggles to lay out what the plan actually was. He knows it's something. He knows it's nefarious. He does quote extensively from the Federalist's coverage, which at least organizes this conspiracy a little bit, so maybe the listeners can understand. But he never submits the alternative explanation about the phones and the monitoring predating Trump. He never really submits that for any kind of fair consideration. And he takes a word that's definitionally ambiguous and tries to wring hours and hours of programming out of it. I spared you many an among that was in there. Now, there might be an indictment of this guy Jaffe. There could be more meat put on the bone that Sussman or others were passing to the FBI or CIA, information that did not wind up panning out about Trump or Trump associates' dealings with the Russians. But what there is not at this point, and I suspect ever, is a reasonable or even rational interpretation of the facts that Trump was spied on and that Hillary Clinton was doing the spying. Those are not among the valid ways to read the actual evidence. And that's it for today's show. Among the GIST staff are Corey Wara, assistant producer, Joel Patterson, GIST senior producer, Michelle Pesca is Peachfish Productions vice president of core services, item and supply chain tech. The GIST is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, check out advertisecast.com/thegist. Umperu deperu duperu, and thanks for listening.